From VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And I'm Joanna Sciarrino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the VinePair podcast. Guys, what's going on? How you doing?
Good.
I feel like
that was a very delayed, like, whether or not you guys are sure you're doing
Am I
okay.
good?
And I want to check in with my friends and see if you guys are
Well, I feel like you wanted you.
Are you okay?
I feel like you could have taken the opportunity to, like, you know, give a little behind the scenes about, you know, your whereabouts.
Okay, I'm still in Charleston.
Yeah. Well, we're recording. I mean,
and I'm in a hotel room.
I feel like people appreciate the effort you go through to be on the podcast when you're traveling.
I have such a jet setting life. Uh-huh. And I'm in Charleston. Yeah, I know. Thanks. Right now I'm in Charleston still. I just had a really nice lunch and now I'm recording. Getting ready for a class I'm about to teach on craft whiskey with Aaron Goldfarb, who has a new book out called Dusty Booze that he did not ask me to blurb. That's okay.
Me neither. It's okay.
It's still good. Yeah, I actually told him that. I was like, you didn't ask me to blurb, man. He goes, they only wanted published authors. And I was like, oh, that kind of really stinks. First of all, I am a published author at the site and also happen to own it. But whatever, that's cool. I didn't. No, you didn't let me blurb your book. Whatever, buddy. But everyone should go out and buy it. It's really good. Yeah. I just started reading it. Holding it right now, actually. He didn't sign it either. It's
rude. Oh, man.
And then going to bounce around Charleston a little bit tonight and then head home.
But have you had anything good to drink yet, Adam?
No, water.
Boo.
Nothing else. No, I want to be like clear-headed for the class.
Can you tell the people
we're going to drink?
Yeah, what are you tasting for this class?
What craft whiskeys are you doing for the class? Yeah.
Well, so that's what the whole class is kind of about. Is like, are these even craft whiskeys?
Right.
Because a lot of them are now owned by larger corporations or private equity. So
Wilderness Trail.
Wilderness Trail, Bardstown.
Yeah.
Pinhook.
Okay, that's still craft, no?
Mm-hmm. High Wire, local.
Yeah.
Frey Ranch, it's the fifth.
Ah, okay.
And there's one.
Still craft.
Still craft. Yeah. And probably our argument is going to be probably the most craft of all of them because also like all of what they make comes
grain
from the farm
to glass
they also
there.
Own.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, sort of like what this, the conversation about like what, how do we actually define craft and does it even matter? And these classes are always fun because you're talking to consumers.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're also going to just do a general class probably on whiskey tasting and, you know, serving whiskey and stuff like that, which is always fun to come back to because I think a lot of us wind up when we sometimes do classes at these other conferences, you know, only talking to trade and it gets really geeky. And these are great because you get to also reconnect and remember what is important to a consumer. I think that's really good as a journalist to reset yourself and understand who you're writing for half the time.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be fun. And then going to a restaurant that Tim's very excited about that he likes here called Sorelli, and then going to Stems and Skins.
Nice.
Because, you know, got to see Matt. But before we talk about what I've drank before this, Joanna, what about you? What have you been drinking?
Yeah, I think the most exciting thing I had to drink this week. We hosted our second Vine Pair After Hours at the office, and it was hosted by Phil Ward, bartender Phil Ward, who is currently at the Long Island, bartends at the Long Island Bar, I think, and nowhere else, right, Adam?
Right.
And done in partnership with Junipero Gin, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. And it was the theme was martinis, and Phil made three different takes on the martini. And I think my favorite was a 50-50 split of gin and Cokie Americano with a bunch of Angostura bitters in it. But that was a really interesting.
It was delicious.
Yeah, delicious. I guess it was a martini. He also did a take on The Last Word that I really enjoyed as well.
It was like a take on his riff that became very well known. And then, like, it was a riff on that riff. It was very geeky.
That was so good.
Yeah, the Last Word one that he did, yeah.
Yeah. So those were...
That was fun.
That was pretty outstanding for me. Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
For me as well.
Yeah. Adam was also there.
That was a great time. And it was really fun to hang out with all the other bartenders in the room. And, yeah, it was a good
time.
You
guys have been getting some heavy hitters for that.
Right?
That's pretty cool.
We have. We're getting another heavy hitter for the next one.
Nice.
Coming up, and yeah, it's great to meet all the people in the room that are huge fans and of him and of us. And anyways, we're gonna keep doing them. They're a great time.
Yeah.
Zach, what about you?
So I had the opportunity, so I've started doing this thing every quarter, more or less, with some friends here in the Washington wine industry, either people on the production side or some other people on sort of the restaurant or media side, of these kind of just group dinners, chance to like hang out, have some good food, drink some wine. So we went to a friend's restaurant called Maripili, which is like a Spanish tapas bar. It's like a year and a half, 2 years old, actually. Is James Beard semifinalist this year, which is very exciting for them. Although, you know, as with anything like that, it kind of changes your business in certain ways. Mm-hmm. We were talking, the owner and I were talking about it a little bit, like, you know, it's definitely, you know, you get a little bit different kind of demands from the public when it's that way. But had lots of great wines. But I think the standouts to me were, I had probably the oldest bottle of Willamette Valley Pinot Noir and the oldest bottle of Washington anything that I've had ever. Mm-hmm. So I had a 92 Pinot Noir from Kramer in the Willamette Valley from this is like back in the days when there was only the Willamette Valley AVA, like none of the sub AVAs existed. So it's from Yamhill Carlton, but like, you know, not appellated as such because the appellation didn't exist then. And similarly had a really interesting 87 cab from Snoqualmie, which is no longer really a functioning winery in Washington anymore, but was made actually by the dad of one of the guys who was at the dinner. So a pretty cool opportunity to step back in time. I thought both were actually in really good shape. You never, absolutely never know with wines like that, of that age from anywhere, but especially from regions where, you know, the winemaking was good, but, you know, has definitely matured and developed a lot in the last, you know, God, 35, 40 years. And it was depressing to order, have wines that old and be like, I'm still meaningfully older than these wines. So, you know, that was always a good moment. But yeah, no, it was really cool. A very fun opportunity and something I'm really enjoying doing. It's not quite, you know, Vine Pair After Hours, but it's my own little Seattle version.
Such nice, as dude. Nice.
Yeah. Adam, anything else that stood out to you in your past week or so?
I mean, I had some Krug.
Oh, okay. At the airport lounge?
No. We had a dinner with some amazing partners on Tuesday and went to a really fun restaurant. Although, again, this happened to me where, like, I don't love when people do this, but we went to Ouija Me.
Okay.
Or Ouija Me?
No. I think the first way you said it was.
Is Ouija Me, yeah.
I think so.
And we started with a bottle of Krug, which was fun. We're doing a big luxury project with Diageo, actually. And so we're with their luxury team. And so that's why we ordered the Krug, because we're sort of talking about luxury. And that's a very high-end wine, obviously. But the thing that happened that was really weird was, like, it was either Somm or the head server, because it's a tasting menu restaurant, came over and we were just chatting about the restaurant, and one of my friends at the table, like, wanted to know the background, and he was like, well, you know, you probably read about us in Pete Wells' article about, you know, the best Korean restaurants in the city right now. I was like, oh man, don't do that.
Yeah,
like, don't do that, don't mention the press you got. Like, maybe that is how a few of us have, one of the ways we learned about you, but, like, don't acknowledge that when we're all now here. Like, it makes us all feel kind of shitty and weird, and, like, we only follow press. Like, you know, I hate when producers do that too. When, like, when you're tasting with them, and they'll be like, especially when because it's another publication that gave them a score. We're the most awarded score by, you know, most awarded liquid by Whiskey Advocate. I'm like, I don't care. Like, I honestly don't care. Like, can I please make the decision? And if I did know that, even, like, now you're clouding me one way or the other. I was like, please don't do that. But it was amazing. And
it's,
I mean,
like,
come on,
the leeks vinaigrette thing that happened to you that time.
Yeah. Again, like, the server's like, well, you might have seen this. This is the viral leeks vinaigrette dish. And you're just like, dude, I don't care. This is viral on TikTok right now. Like, your restaurant also just happens to be super popular and very hard to get into.
Maybe it's just me, but I also don't want anyone in a restaurant to say the word viral about anything.
Yeah.
Makes me feel bad.
Don't do that.
It's a little cringe.
Don't do that. Please don't do that. And at least, like, this wasn't, you know, no one knew who we were. We were just paying customers, so it's fine. So I guess I can't get as angry at him. But there's nothing that bothers me more when we are talking as journalists to a product or a liquid, et cetera, and they reference a score from someone else, or press they've gotten from someone else, or, you know, press that a restaurant has gotten, or a bar program. Like, you're literally, all you are doing is basically telling us you've already been covered, so you don't need our coverage.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You guys just heard the editor-in-chief say, yeah. Which is her way of saying, uh-huh.
Well, I don't think that people realize that that's how it comes off to another publication.
I don't think they do either. But like, that's like you going up when you're trying to date and you're like, by the way, a lot of other people have dates with me too. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, okay, well.
No, I don't want to date you.
Good luck dating the other people then. I hope it works out for you.
Well, and it's also, I mean, it does kind of, even not to people in media, I feel like to guests it can come off that way as like, oh, well, I guess you don't need our business.
Yeah.
Like, if you're so busy, if you're so, like, in demand, like, I guess maybe we shouldn't be here. But, yeah, no, that's weird.
Yeah. I also think it's weird when, like, I don't know, again, because you just never know. Like, I think it's weird when a brand, like, leans into, like, one piece of press they got and makes it their entire marketing strategy. Oh, I also think that's weird. I'm like, you don't know how many consumers like this publication, don't like this publication, are aware of this publication, or not aware of this publication. And I think a lot of research supports that, like, doesn't 100% move the needle here, guys. So what are we doing? But anyways, that's just me. And that's kind of what this felt like. It's like you're leaning into being like, here, let me remind you of why I think you're here.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually a good segue. Lead into our topic today. Yeah.
Exactly. So we have another amazing listener question. This one comes to us from Jacob Fergus, who's a beverage director in the Dallas area and a loyal listener. Thanks, Jake, for always listening to the pod. And I just called you Jake, but maybe it's Jacob. And people hate when sometimes their name's short. So I really apologize, Jacob. He sent in a voice memo a week ago. So, Zach, why don't we play it and then take it from there?
Hey, VinePair team. Your episodes recently regarding the challenge of selling wine and groupthink in the industry have me completely convinced that you are correct, and I'm looking to how I can act in my market, which is Dallas, to push our restaurant industry forward. My question is, what should local media be saying about wine? I wonder if this might make for a good future topic of discussion, both from your experience in restaurant operations, but also in PR and publishing. What I mean through this is that there's a gap in the food chain between major national media like VinePair and the actual on or off-premise point of sale. Because local writers usually lack the product knowledge, market insights, or simply time and space to engage in writing about wine, it ends up going largely ignored. When they do get written about, it always seems to be in a very dated way that's reinforcing the stereotypes that we know are damaging wine. I don't look at this as a failing by the individual writers, but rather reflect the weird position that these publications are in. So the two main questions to this are, what kind of wine writing do you think would be effective in those formats? Is it relegated only to critiquing and publicizing the restaurants themselves? And do the restaurants and retailers have a responsibility to communicate with the publications on trends that we see in the market, and what form would that take?
Okay, so besides answering your question that, like, local journalism is dead, Jacob, and, like, that's all I have to say for all of this, I think it is a really good question, and something that I think a lot of people have thought about. I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I know ever since I started VinePair, my dad has always thought it's been really fun to send me, like, the wine column that runs in the Opelika Auburn News, like local paper, like once every month, and be like, what do you think of this? And I'm like, it's horrible, Dad. I don't know what to tell you. This is like, this is a, you know, someone who is clearly retired as like who is a hobbyist who they're probably paying nothing, who's decided to write about the wines they bought at Publix today. Like, I don't know what to tell you. And, you know, it's like basically whatever this person wants to write about, because they're probably paid nothing and the paper thinks every once in a while they should have a wine column.
Right. If there is dedicated wine coverage at all, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, even the Times probably struggles with this. Like, how valuable is the column? Like, how much is it? Like, at the end of the day, I think unless you're a specialty publication like us, if you're at a large publication, anything you do in media, so this is going to be like more of a under the – so I used to teach a media business class at Columbia, so let's strap in.
Yeah.
Oh, Professor Adam, everybody, let's listen.
Yeah, so any, you know, column inches that you have, or now digital space, whatever, has to somehow drive advertising.
Yeah.
Or drive revenue, unless you know, you have a very strong stated mission. So for example, for a large publisher like The Times, et cetera, like the mission is the news coverage, right? That's the stuff that like they feel very committed to, that sort of they're using the revenue to continue to invest in, as just a like whether or not it sells advertisers, and usually it doesn't because no advertisers usually want to be anywhere near news, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Like you don't want to show up next to all the shit happening in the world and whatever. So that's like the mission. And then everything else that exists, including wine coverage, has to somewhat help drive ad revenue. Because whether we like it or not, that's still how media gets made, right? And that's why ad dollars are so precious in the business, and why you hear people every like 10 years screaming the sky is falling and media is dying, because ad revenue goes up and down and people, you know, marketers play around with where they're going to put their revenue. But on the journalism side, like journalism really needs advertisers, or you have to be nonprofit. And if you're nonprofit, and I think this is really important, we've talked about this before, like if we go to nonprofit journalism, like a lot of what all of us do goes away, right? Including wine writing and spirits writing, et cetera, because like no one really wants to pay for that in a lot of ways, right? Maybe scores in a very small percentage of the population, like three people. but otherwise, it's a lot of it has to do with ad revenue. And then, you know, you're getting to sit next to and be seen by people interested in the topic that you want to be seen next to. So in local news, especially, right, like it becomes very hard to justify a lot of this, of these columns, because you really can't sell ads against them, right? You don't have the manpower, and there's not a local team that's going to say, hey, I'm going to just use the Auburn Opelika News, for example, right? I know that Jacob's in Dallas, and it's a bigger market. I think it was the fastest growing city right now in America, about to be the third or fourth biggest city in America. So it's a big city. But in Auburn, let's say, right, you're not going to have any alcohol advertisers that are going to advertise next to this column, mm-hmm. right? Because who's really doing that? Nobody. They are going to think about how to reach people maybe on billboards, or like where they think is potentially more effective advertising, where they can reach a larger number of people when they're advertising in the local market. And then the other types of advertisers you could see around this kind of coverage are not going to be interested, because either A, maybe they're local restaurants, but like then maybe they want to be around food content more than a wine column. It's pretty rare that you have like a massive amount of wine focused local restaurants in a market, right? Or you're going to want to be, I don't know, if like you're a bank, maybe you want to be here, but like automobiles definitely don't. Right. So you start to like the local car dealership's not going to advertise near you. Maybe the local bank will. Like it starts to become harder and harder to justify whether or not this is a column that helps build readership and sell ads. And so you basically like you wind up eliminating it. And that's why these columns are getting eliminated almost everywhere, except in markets where the market is very connected to this industry. So I think a perfect example of this, like the New York Times is not a great example, because the New York Times now is a national publication. And so while, and we've criticized him for this, I think, and he gets a lot of criticism from a lot of people from this, Eric Asimov will say he writes for a local paper, and that's why it's okay that he only tastes wine that you can get in New York and writes about mostly wine programs in New York. Like, that's actually not true. He writes for a national publication. Same I would argue for Letty Teague, right? She writes for a national publication, the Wall Street Journal. The San Francisco Chronicle is not a national publication. Now, there's people in the wine industry that are aware of what the San Francisco Chronicle is writing, but I would argue that besides the tech coverage they're doing, there's very rarely anyone in the rest of the country that is linking to news stories, et cetera, reported by the San Francisco Chronicle. But they have a wine writer. They actually have two, because that part of the country yeah. is very strongly invested in wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that makes sense for them, because it's actually news.
Yeah.
But other places, it's just a lot more difficult. And also if like, the scene isn't, you just don't think that the scene is as robust, et cetera, it becomes really difficult as a publisher to justify the cost of these writers. And I know that is extremely depressing, but that is the business answer for why we don't have as much wine writing specifically and local papers as probably a lot of us would want there to be.
And also, I mean, kind of like you mentioned, it's not going to be as consistent or as regular, right? They can't afford to have like a regular wine column. It'll be occasional coverage, and it might be from a food critic or coming out of the food section. And so, you know, part of what I think Jacob was asking here is like, you know, I guess part of the issue is like then there's this lack of expertise and we're not talking about wine in a really not educated, but educated way. In a way that's kind of pushing the industry forward in the way that we need it to, in a way that other maybe like drinks publications are. And that's just like kind of the unfortunate reality, as Adam mentioned. And even at food publishers, like I was previously at Bon Appetit, and beverage coverage back then was very much ancillary to what we were doing in the food space, which means that you're only going to kind of scratch the surface your coverage on drinks and wine specifically.
Yeah. So as someone who actually wrote a local wine column, drinks column for years. Yeah. But granted, did it for Seattle Weekly, which was, you know, the sort of weekly Village Voice-esque publication. At one point it was actually owned by the same company, now is no longer. But, you know, they could afford to have me do that because, quite honestly, they didn't pay me very much.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I was working full-time in restaurants, and it was just a thing I did to, you know, have a different outlet for my knowledge and explore things that I couldn't explore as a, you know, as a server, sommelier, wine director, whatever. But relatively few publications are interested in that in any kind of more comprehensive standpoint. And the answer I always got, we've kind of been dancing around this a little bit, is that, you know, when it comes to journalism, it comes to sort of these kinds of publications, whether they're local newspapers or, you know, regional magazines and things like that, is basically everybody eats, not everybody drinks. And therefore, there's always been a belief that food coverage is more universal, is more appealing, and as Adam pointed out, is easier to connect with, you know, to connect to advertising, right? Not only individual restaurants are more interested in advertising around food content, but also just brands of all sorts are happy to be connected. You know, if you're on the same page as the restaurant review in that given edition, no one's going to have an issue with that. You know, maybe if it's a pan, they'll love it, but or whatever, maybe they do. It gets eyeballs at least. And I think with wine writing and drinks writing more broadly, it's part there's a lack of expertise. It's part that people with that expertise are not always great writers. I mean, we all know lots of people who know lots about drink, and relatively few of them are good at writing because it's a skill, and they're not necessarily skills that go hand in hand with one another. And lastly, I think the truth is that relatively few markets, and I think this comes to Jacob's point specifically, have enough interesting going on to cover in any way other than the way they already cover it, which is sort of openings and closings, right? Like that is a lot of the coverage that the bar scene, the wine scene in most markets get, which is, hey, here's a new wine bar, here's a new cocktail spot, here's this place is closing. And like the kind of the number of places, the number of dynamic, interesting, kind of novel or just, you know, kind of meaningful establishments in most markets, even pretty big ones, is relatively small and doesn't really merit regular coverage. So then you end up in the situation that is being described here that I've been a part of, which is, okay, so when one of those places does open and is reviewed by the restaurant critic or the food critic or whomever, are they covering it in a way that is intelligent and thoughtful? And we've talked about this on the podcast. There is an episode in the archives about this very topic. And I think the answer is generally no, because generally food critics are not hired for their drink knowledge. They have it, great. But most of them and most of their editors and most of the people who hire them consider that sort of like, you know, ancillary. Yeah, maybe you mentioned that this new spot has X number of bottles of wine on their list, or they tend to focus on this in their cocktail program, but that's about all you can expect to get. And I don't think there's really a path to more. I don't think there's the public demand for it. Mm-hmm. And there certainly isn't the demand on the publication side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that's all of these points are really excellent. And unfortunately, it's just the issue that we deal with in local media. You know, and I think that there's just, you guys have both made the points really well. There's not a lot to cover either.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that one of the other things that's really important to mention here is that I don't think that often local media has a really great sense. Look, okay, let me back up. We're already talking about the fact that there's a lot of heritage media that are national media that don't have great data and that don't really know how to do data analysis and understand what readers want, et cetera. Like, they can move to the whims of Google and like what's showing up in search and how they're doing with search traffic. But like, there's the amount of publications that actually understand their audience is shocking. Look, you could say this is true for a variety of industries, including probably the alcohol industry, right? We talked about this we've beaten wine up enough about that. But local media is even less so in terms of understanding of the audience and what the audience wants. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, I think there also just becomes this general assumption that the audience is not going to be interested in this, or that, you know, the only people that are interested in wine or beverage related coverage are wine snobs, and that there must not be a lot of them. I actually don't 100% think that's true, but that I think is the assumption. And so therefore, the only kinds of articles you often get are articles like one that Jacob has, you know, when he initially emailed us about the question before he sent it in, you know, before he recorded it and sent it in, mentioned an article that had published in his, you know, local paper about sort of just how to read a wine list. Like, these are the kinds of, I mean, that's the kind of shit my dad sends me that runs in Opelika and Auburn News. Like, and I'm like, what do you think? Is this good advice? I'm like, Dad, I mean, you know, when to order red wine, when to order white, mm-hmm. how to open champagne around the holidays. Like, that's the deepest you're getting. You're not getting, I think, the coverage that ourselves and someone like Jacob wants, which is like, here are the beverage trends we're seeing in Dallas, and here are the most exciting wines to try at the most exciting restaurants. Like, they're not doing that because they don't think anyone wants that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think another part of that is also that if you do have the resources for somebody to be, you know, writing this coverage, it's going to take a lot of work to find those columns, right? Week after week. And I think we do end up seeing that with some of the like local or regional publications that do have drinks coverage. Sometimes the columns are a little questionable. I think that would take a lot of work and a lot of digging, right? To be talking to new bars, getting in there, like coming up with recurring column ideas that will be compelling and read. And then, you're really banking on there being people who want to read these things.
And I think it's so hard to disentangle what is a trend locally versus a much larger trend if you are very focused on your local market. I mean, I think a thing that, you know, not to toot our own horn too much, but I think a thing that's a strength of VinePair as a publication is, you know, is being on top of trends that have locally or regionally focused, or may have started one place and spread. But I think it's really hard when you're in a local market to really know, you know, I mean, again, it's just common sense. If you're the wine writer in Seattle or a drinks writer in Seattle or in, Omaha or in Chicago or whatever, unless you are extremely well-traveled and extremely well-read and extremely well-connected, all things that are kind of difficult to be on, especially on a journalist salary, it's really hard to know if this thing that you're seeing in your market is anything more than the local expression of a broader trend, which could still be worth writing about, but is a different kind of story than, hey, this drink or this specific bottle of wine or this style or something is really popping off here. And it's really hard to have that perspective. It was an issue for me, quite honestly, covering stuff locally. And I got away with it to some extent because whether or not my audience knew that something that was trendy in Seattle had originated somewhere else wasn't even really the point. It was interesting to them, I hope, if it was trendy in Seattle. But, you know, it's just really difficult to do that. And I certainly, to Joanna's point, felt the struggle some weeks to be like, well, what the fuck am I supposed to write about? Like, do I do my yearly, you know, piece about X, Y, or Z thing that's seasonal? I guess sometimes there was definitely some of that. And sometimes it was, you know, you just kind of try and find angles. But yeah, it's difficult. And again, it's difficult to do without a lot of resources. And since, mm-hmm. you know, all of these publications are under-resourced in a lot of cases, it's not surprising that their coverage tends to be like the piece that Jacob sent to it, which is like sort of outsourcing the expertise to other people, which can work, but it ends up often being, you know, it just doesn't end up adding much. You know, you could get the same piece in 200 other publications because people around the restaurant scene are going to say kind of the same stuff about how to read a wine list. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's not to take a shot at that piece or that publication or that author, but it's more just a like, yeah, there are unfortunately good reasons, but I will add one last thing. And then I know we got,
I have one last thing too. It's kind of off of your point though, which is that a point that you just made, which is that a lot of times people are just going to Google these questions anyway,
yeah.
and it's going to totally cannibalize whatever you're going to get from your local media. And that's part of it too, right? So what's the incentive to even cover this stuff when most people are just going to go find it on Google?
Yeah.
But I do think that Jacob's last question to us, which is sort of, do restaurants and retailers have a responsibility to communicate to these publications? I mean, shit, reach out, you know, make a connection with the mm-hmm. people who cover your industry, with the food writers, with the editors, et cetera. And if you do have something that you think is novel or interesting or a trend you've noticed, I mean, part of the way you build up this part of your local and regional media scene is by giving people ideas. I mean, we all know, we take pitches from y'all all the time. This episode is because Jacob reached out to us and had an idea for a topic. And I can assure you, your local and regional publications are desperate for topics, desperate for ideas. And if you have an interesting trend or you have an interesting idea, pitch it to them. Hell, write it yourself, maybe.
Yep.
Maybe you are one of those people with product knowledge who also knows something. Like, they are not above, very much not above taking your ideas.
Cool. If you have a question, as always, hit us up at podcast@vinepair.com. Feel free to send a voice memo, or if you want us to approve the question first before you record it, you can always write it, and then we'll get back to you. But we really appreciate these. They've been really fun to answer. We have had a few more already come in. So let us know what you're interested in. Jacob, thank you as always for the question. Sorry to be a downer about local media. And Zach and Joanna, I'll talk to you Friday.
Have a great week.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now, through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Jabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered, and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.